This first experiment that we're doing is to determine the molar volume of an ideal gas at STP. And since this is such new information, let me break each of these phrases apart to tell you a little bit more about them. So molar volume, what does that mean? Well, it means pretty much like it sounds. It is the mole of it is the volume of one mole of a gas. And then, what is an ideal gas? I didn't really go into the characteristics of an ideal gas during lecture, but that is something I'm going to do during the lab lecture today. I'll just give you the short version of what it is right now. It is a hypothetical gas that obeys simple laws. More specifically, we have PV equals NRT, a very simple expression. So as far as STP, what does that refer to? That is a standard set of conditions. Okay, so we're going to come up with some kind of gas that is going to act as close as possible to this mythical ideal gas, and we're going to try to come up with what the volume of that gas would be if we had one mole of it at STP conditions. So we're going to go over each one of these bits further. But first thing we need to do is talk about which gas would we be using in real life, and that turns out to be hydrogen gas. So let's talk about producing hydrogen gas. All right, if you were really in person in lab doing this, would be taking a piece of magnesium ribbon, which, if you can allow me just a moment, I had a picture of that I wanted to show everyone. So hopefully this is going to come across right now. If you are listening to this lecture later, what I'm showing everyone is a picture of what's known as magnesium ribbon, and that is magnesium metal that has been pounded into a very thin ribbon-like form. It's less than a centimeter wide. It's usually very narrow stuff, and in fact, it's so narrow that you easily can tear the pieces just with your bare hands. So it makes it very easy to measure a specific mass of the stuff. So that's why that's the form we generally use in lab. Aside from the fact that it allows to more easily conduct the experiment, which you'll see once I show you the experimental setup. So let me switch back to the iPad one moment. There we go. So the way we're going to produce the hydrogen gas is through a redox reaction. So that's where we will take solid magnesium, this ribbon, and we're going to react it with an excess of hydrochloric acid. And, of course, we will produce the hydrogen gas. And then the byproduct will be magnesium chloride, which will be soluble because chlorides usually are soluble. And this is magnesium that goes along with it. And that's not one of those exceptions. In other words, chlorides can precipitate under certain circumstances, but this is not one of them. Now, let's investigate this as far as it being a redox reaction. So, can anybody tell me what the oxidation state of magnesium would be?
Is it zero?
It is zero. And could you tell me why? You can tell me, I'm a doctor. Yes, it is an unreacted element. So, oxidation state is all about whether something has gained or lost electrons. Well, if you're an element that hasn't reacted yet, you haven't gained or lost any electrons. So, that's why it has an oxidation state of zero. Now, what about hydrogen chloride? What are going to be the oxidation states there?
Negative one, positive one.
Okay, which one's which? That's right. So hydrogen is going to be plus one. Chloride is going to be negative one, which the name chloride itself kind of gives it away because chloride means negatively charged chlorine. And that totally makes sense because chlorine is more electronegative than hydrogen. So it's going to win the tug of war, you could say, in the bond. And so that's why chlorine ends up with the negative one oxidation state. And then the hydrogen, that just follows the normal rule that in most substances, hydrogen is plus one. And that's because in most substances, hydrogen is the less electronegative element. Now, we're talking about HCl, though. What about the hydrogen gas? What's the oxidation state there? Zero. That's right. Because, again, it's an element. And what about the oxidation states in the substance magnesium chloride? That's right, because this is an ionic compound. So if we simply look at the periodic table and look where magnesium is located, it makes total sense that it would be plus two. And then notice I'm not giving the total oxidation state for all the oxygens. I'm only giving the oxidation state of one oxygen. And that's to set you up to thinking more properly when you get to next quarter, Chem 1C. Because you'll be doing an awful lot of redox chemistry in 1C, because you'll be learning about electrochemistry, batteries and such. So any questions about how I came up with the oxidation states? Okay. Now, in any redox reaction, we have a reduction. And we have an oxidation. So, which thing got reduced? Because if it's redox, something got reduced. Are y'all having food coma out there? Are y'all, like, binge-watching your favorite shows while I'm doing my thing here? Okay, so I'm seeing a bunch of answers come in. I'm seeing chloride, hydrogen, magnesium. Well, what does reduction mean?
Loss.
What's that?
Oxidation is loss, reduction is gain.
That's right. Oxidation is loss of electrons, and reduction is gain of electrons. So which thing gained electrons? Hydrogen. Yes, there we go. Because if you look at hydrogen, it went from an oxidation state of plus one to zero, which means it was reduced. And then what got oxidized? Not chloride, because if you look at it, chlorine is negative one to start with and negative one to end with. Yes, it's the magnesium. Because the magnesium started out zero, but it ends up plus two. And that means it lost electrons in the process. So magnesium went from zero to plus two. So it was oxidized. Now, we have the terms oxidizing reagent, reducing reagent, which is the same thing as oxidizing agent and reducing agent, which is the same thing as oxidizer and reducer. So which substance was the oxidizer? Oh, I'm sorry, I see someone raising their hand. So, Sean.
Yeah, just really quickly, can you explain why the chloride's oxidation number on the product side of the equation is just negative one and not negative two?
Yes, because that represents the oxidation state for each individual atom, which is the way we're supposed to count oxidation state. So let me put the note here that this is per atom. Sorry, I missed your hand at first. Not everybody knows how to use that, so I didn't see you.
I just raised it, but thank you.
Oh, okay. So back to the question, though. Which substance was the oxidizer? Which substance, not which atom? That's right, HCl. Because you cannot just put H plus in a bottle. So it is the whole substance, HCl, which is the oxidizer. Because the oxidizer is the thing that takes electrons. But if it's taking electrons, that means it's getting electrons, which means it's getting reduced. Now, what about the reducer? Which one is the reducer? That's right, magnesium. And that makes chemical sense because it's an element on the left-hand side of the periodic table, which are those are the elements that tend to lose electrons anyways. And reducer means something that gives electrons away. But if it gives electrons away, that means it lost electrons, which means it got oxidized. So any questions about this discussion so far of just what this reduction-oxidation reaction is? Okay, so then put this back into context again. The reason we care about this reaction is this is how we're making the hydrogen gas for the experiment. Yes, so for anybody, in case you end up with Wi-Fi where you're not able to participate, I am recording this. It's going to be posted later, so don't worry if you're not able to participate. And then, yes, oxidizer and oxidizing reagent, or oxidizing agent, three different ways of saying exactly the same thing. Okay, so then, like I was saying, I was wanting to put this back into context. We're trying to measure the volume of a mole of an ideal gas, and we're making that gas using this reaction. So in terms of our future calculations, we're going to want to know exactly how much hydrogen gas we have. So in this reaction, what is the limiting reagent? And you would notice if you were really observant, you noticed the way I phrased things earlier, or if you, shocking, read the procedure. Any guesses out there? What's the limiting reagent? Magnesium, yes it is, because it's a small strip of magnesium that's going to be swimming in a big pool of hydrochloric acid. So the limiting reagent in this reaction is magnesium. because hydrochloric acid is used in large excess. Therefore, and this is the point, the moles of hydrogen formed will be determined by the moles of magnesium. With one condition, if all the magnesium reacts successfully, and what does that mean? Well, in numerical terms, that means that the reaction has to have 100% yield. And you might say, well, why wouldn't the reaction have 100% yield? Because it actually does turn out the reaction go very smoothly. Well, what if not all the magnesium is truly magnesium? And that's just because, like a lot of other substances, magnesium rusts out in open oxygen. So in other words, it reacts with oxygen. Now, I'm going to switch pages here, so if you have any questions, please let me know, or if you're taking screenshots, please go ahead and do so before I move on. Okay. So then what happens, like I said, is that the magnesium reacts with oxygen. And in fact, this is a very interesting demonstration to do, where you take a piece of magnesium metal, not too huge, big enough to make an impact, and you burn it in oxygen, you light it. Now, of course, we're not supposed to be doing any chemistry at home, because in this case, of course, you're burning something, but that's not the only hazard. If you did this reaction, the light that's produced is extraordinarily bright, to the point where if you're looking at it straight on, you could damage your eyesight. So that's why this is not a demonstration you should ever try on your own, but I'm just mentioning what would happen. So if you don't ignite it, it still happens on a much slower time scale that this will form magnesium oxide solid. Now, to do this a little more quickly than the last time, both magnesium and oxygen are elements, so they're both going to start out with oxidation state of zero. And then magnesium is plus 2 in the product and oxygen is minus 2 because magnesium is in the second main group column of elements and oxygen is 2 columns over from the noble gases. And so that's why it tends to be negative 2. So, magnesium naturally reacts with oxygen to form a layer of magnesium oxide on the outside. And again, the reason this matters is because we're trying to figure out exactly how many moles of magnesium we have, because we're trying to figure out exactly how many moles of hydrogen we have. So to ensure the correct number of moles of magnesium are present, The surface of the magnesium should be sanded first with sandpaper in order to remove this layer of magnesium oxide.
Good afternoon, Professor.
Hello, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Fine. Okay, anyone have any questions about this, the magnesium oxide? Okay, so now we know how the hydrogen gas is going to be made. Now we should finally get around to talking about ideal gases. In other words, why was hydrogen the right choice for this experiment. Now, if you end up taking physics, you're going to get a lot more about ideal gases than what I talk about here. But the general model is this. What we do is we pretend that the gas is a collection of particles of some type, atoms, molecules, whatever it might be. And as all these individual little objects, we imagine that they're bouncing around in some kind of container, and that the pressure that these particles generate is due to them bouncing into that container. So there's a mathematical model you can develop which tries to express what's going to happen as all these different particles bounce off the walls of the container. And that's actually related to this kinetic molecular theory that I might have mentioned the other day in either lecture or lab. Now, if you make certain simplifications, certain assumptions about how all these different atoms are going to behave, well, then we can come up with some useful mathematical equations. And that's why I said in physics that you might have a very in-depth discussion, because there's a lot of characteristics that you could talk about. In chemistry, we only tend to focus on a few of these restrictions or assumptions, and I put a slightly different spin on these than the ones that might be in your textbook, but I get to the same point. But let me write down what the general point is here, that if certain assumptions are made about the behavior of a gas, any gas can be described by the same equation. This hypothetical gas is known as an ideal gas. So, what are some of these characteristics that I'm talking about? Well, There are three that I'm going to focus on. The first is this. That gas particles occupy no volume. To take a rather silly example, if you had a collection of marbles and you put them into a container, how much room those marbles will have to wiggle around in is not very large because the marbles themselves take up a lot of the room in the container. And of course, gas molecules aren't anywhere near that large, but they do take up physical room. And so that technically takes away from how much room they have to bounce around in. And so that means that you really have to make an adjustment for what the true volume of the container would be. So gas particles are assumed that they occupy no volume, because otherwise it would affect the volume of the container. Then, the next assumption is that none of the gas particles experience any kind of attractions with each other. So that means water would be a poor choice as something to act as an ideal gas, because water is very polar, and so that means it has lots of attractions between molecules. So we'll come back to hydrogen in a minute, but that's the point, that an ideal gas doesn't have these attractions. Why does this matter? Because pressure is effectively these molecules hitting the sides of the container. So if the molecules are tied up and interacting with each other instead of hitting the container, well, then that would affect the pressure in the container. Then the last restriction is best expressed if you are a physics student, because the last one is that gas particles collide elastically. To translate into English, yes, gas particles can collide, because maybe they don't interact, they don't experience attractive forces, but nothing said they can't bump into each other. But when they do, they don't lose any energy. So gas particles do not lose energy when they collide. And you might not recall this, but I think it was in lecture. Oh, what do I mean by attractions? Okay, so if you imagine water, where oxygen is much more electronegative than hydrogen, that means hydrogen is going to be partially positively charged and oxygen is going to be partially negatively charged. And so that means that partially negatively charged oxygen on one molecule is going to be attracted to the partially positively charged hydrogen on another molecule. And that's what I mean by attraction, positive and negative electrostatic attractions. Sean, question.
Just out of curiosity, since gas particles don't experience any attractions, does that mean all gas particles are neutrally charged particles?
Ooh, interesting thing. He just asked, well, if there are no attractions, does that mean that an ideal gas, you wouldn't have any charges? I assume that would have to be the case, because otherwise you'd have obvious electrostatic attractions you couldn't get around. Nobody's ever asked me that before, so I'm not sure how that would be handled in the model. My guess is it couldn't be. So, interesting question. Okay, but I noticed these questions before I made my final point here on this page, which is that if we were looking at this equation, PV equals NRT, in lecture, I think it was the other day, I said that the NRT is related to energy. And so if particles lose energy, that means it would most closely affect temperature. Well, notice how there's three variables in the ideal gas law, and there's three variables I've underlined in this discussion here. So that's why I have these three different assumptions. Now, I had a student that was, you could say, aggressively curious one quarter. He just wanted to know every detail about everything, which was great, but kept me on my toes a little bit. And he apparently looked up, and I don't know the reference, so that's why I have to tell this as a story, because I didn't verify it for my own self. But he came up with a reference that said that the temperature effect really doesn't apply in real life. Like, in real life, it's pretty much true that the molecules don't lose energy. When they collide, do they bond? That's a different question outside of this model. So we're going to pretend they don't react along with they don't interact. Okay? So, as I was saying, the temperature is really not an issue, but in real life, the pressure and volume effects are. So, in fact, later on in the quarter, we will see a real gas law to go along with the ideal gas law, and the two corrections that are in that real gas law are for volume and for pressure. Are the elastic collisions with the gas particles themselves, the container, or both? Everything. That no matter what the gas particles collide with, they don't lose energy. So we took a break at slightly the wrong moment because I didn't quite circle back and relate this whole discussion back to the main point. We were talking about the characteristics of an ideal gas because we're trying to talk about why is hydrogen a good choice for this experiment. So H2 hydrogen is a good gas to use for an ideal gas experiment. Because the molecules occupy very little volume. And in fact, I forgot to look up between class whether it is hydrogen, the molecule, or helium, which is a smaller object. But helium's a lot rarer gas and a lot harder to get a hold of. And it's not something that you can just make in a test tube like we're effectively going to do. So hydrogen's a much more practical choice, and it's still true that the molecules occupy very little volume, and they have low, what are known as intermolecular forces, generally abbreviated IMF. And that was, for example, what I was talking about earlier, that if you have a positively charged or partially positively charged atom on one molecule, and it could attract to a negatively or partially negatively charged atom on another molecule, and that is an attractive electrostatic force. And that's an example of an intermolecular force. So that was the point of explaining why are we using hydrogen, and that was also how I introduced what an ideal gas was. So now we know that we're supposed to be measuring this molar volume of an ideal gas. We've got the ideal gas part down finally. At STP, let's go ahead and talk about this STP part, which is standard temperature and pressure. Now, what exactly qualifies as STP has changed over time, but in general it is this. It's a set of conditions used for comparing the behavior of gases. And when I say that things have changed, when I took chemistry, and so I'll call this the traditional definition, the conditions were 0 degrees Celsius and 1 atmosphere pressure. And this is the set of units that, in fact, we're going to use for the lab. But there is something that's also known as the standard state. And so what I call the more modern definition is related to that standard state, which is 25 degrees Celsius and 1 bar pressure. Now, the practical difference between an ATM and a bar is minimal, but a bar is a metric-related unit. So that's why the bar is a maybe more scientific way to do things. And as far as 0 degrees versus 25 degrees, well, when was the last time you did chemistry in a lab at 0 degrees? Not really the most practical, not really the most practical temperature. Maybe you're in Denver, but you're probably not in a lab. You're probably outside playing in the snow. So 25 makes more sense. So we are going to determine STP behavior defined as 0 degrees Celsius and 1 atmosphere pressure. Now, the next part of this lab lecture this morning was something exactly what I ended up doing in lecture today, which is to explain how could we come up with an equation where you can convert one set of conditions into another. And because I already did it in the morning lecture, the morning lab, I'm going to do it here too just for symmetry. But maybe I'll express it more quickly because we did already see it in lecture. So we already know what the ideal gas law is, even if we don't know the full historical development of it yet. And it is, of course, PV equals nRT. So in lecture, what I discussed is this. Suppose that we have a fixed amount of gas, but we have a change in temperature or pressure possible. So we could have P1V1 equal to nRT1, which would be the one set of conditions. And then we have P2V2 equal to nRT2. As our other set of conditions. So in an enclosed sample, NR, that quantity, is fixed. And to be a little more specific about it, R, remember I had quoted earlier as being the gas constant. Which, it's a constant. And then in a enclosed sample, with no possibility of anything leaking out, the number of moles can't change. Or to put it another way, N is also constant. So that's why This morning, I rewrote both of these equations in the same way, where I put the variables p, v, and t on one side, and I left the constants n and r on the other side. And then I said, well, okay, if we have nr on one side, which is the same thing as nr on the other side, then we can combine the two equations, which I just circled the wrong things. Let me do this. So these two now equivalent things we put together. And so we get the overall equation, p1 v1 over t1 is equal to p2 v2 over t2. And all the ones, again, just as a reminder, those are for the conditions in lab. Which the point of that is it will be what is measured. And then the other side here, the twos, that represents STP. Which, again, just to be very explicit about it, P2 is going to be one atmosphere, and T2 is going to be 273 Kelvin. And from that equation, we have our overall goal, which is V2, that is our ideal volume. Again, that is the goal of the experiment. So now we're seeing a little more connection. And I know I'm repeating, but that's because I'm not there to show you things and you don't have a lab to look at anything. So the purpose of the lab is to come up with the molar volume of an ideal gas. This doesn't necessarily involve a mole here, but now we do have the ideal volume. So one last small calculation we would do is to divide through by the number of moles to turn it into the molar volume. So at least now you can see where V is going to come from. So of an ideal gas, well, we talked about what an ideal gas is and why hydrogen's our choice at STP. Well, we've talked about STP. So we've talked about all of it except how do we do the silly lab? So that's what we'll talk about next. First, though, any questions before we move on? And go ahead and take your screenshots, if you'd like to, of this page. Okay, then coming in for the finish here. Let's see how the experiment's going to work. So the way that you start the experiment off is with a long tube. Looks like a really, really long test tube. And it has a strange name to it, which is eudiometer. Now, I had a lot of brain power, I guess, when I was a kid. So I was interested in languages a lot. So at different times in my life, I have taken French, Spanish, Russian, Polish, and Hindi. And I know just enough words in Farsi to sometimes know if you're smack talking me. And that's about it. So, because I was a busy kid. So the point of this story is this thing U in eudiometer. So that U is a Greek prefix meaning good, like in the word euphemism. That's a good phrase, a good way of something, good way of saying something absolutely terrible. So U means good. Eudiometer, that means a good meter. Well, what is it measuring that's good? So this goes back to a little chemical history, because in Western chemical science, a lot of the earlier experiments in quantitative measurement were measurement of gases, because people were really hung up on, what is this thing, fire? And we'll talk a little bit more about that chemical history when we get the chance. But that's what led eventually to the discovery of oxygen, which, of course, is really good stuff for us, right? So something that's good, something that has oxygen, something that's a gas, there's your UDometer. Yeah. And maybe I mentioned it in the morning lab section instead of the lecture, but just to give you another idea that I was a busy kid. I grew up playing piano, but then when I got to junior high, I also started playing clarinet so I could be in a band. And for the last 20 years, I've been playing sitar and tabla. So there you go. Anyways, moving on with the chemistry, what you would do in real life is you would fill up the bottom of this. Do I know all those languages fluently? Well, I've lost some of it, but I knew enough French that when I went to Paris, that I was able to understand when they told me that I needed to hurry and get to the metro or I wasn't going to get back to my hotel before it all closed down. And at one point, I was fluent enough in Russia that I lived there for 6 weeks on a language program. And I've been to India 3 times. And the formal language, I don't know. But if you're speaking Hindi and you're speaking just general everyday things, watch what you're saying around me. Yeah. Anyways, back to the chemistry. So, at the bottom, you're going to have hydrochloric acid. Rather concentrated. I think it's 6 molar. I forget without looking at the procedure. But let's call it 6. And you're supposed to add on top of that water. Which, if you had a really good high school chemistry instructor, you know you're not supposed to do that. Because if you mix just a few drops of water in with hydrochloric acid, and it's really really concentrated hydrochloric acid, then you can get the water to suddenly vaporize, which means it could splatter. But we're not using concentrated enough acid, and it's in a controlled enough environment that it works out to be fine, even if it's not what you're normally supposed to do. And the reason we do it this way is because you take a piece of magnesium ribbon, that stuff I was showing you earlier, and you attach it to a stopper, which that stopper has a hole in it. And so here's our piece of magnesium metal that's holding on to dear life to that stopper. But because you're putting it in the water, it doesn't start reacting right away. You have to wait till you turn it upside down, and then the hydrochloric acid dribbles down to the bottom of the container, and that's when the reaction starts. So I point this out because it's not following normal safety, because when do you get told, put your finger on the stopper that's got hydrochloric acid in it? But that's because, in theory, it's hanging around at the bottom. That's one thing. The other thing is if you're using gloves, and if really it is hanging around at the bottom, it is low risk, even though it sounds really strange to do. All right, so let me draw this UDometer the way it's going to end up with. In real life. Gosh, I love technology sometimes. So what I'm going to draw in light blue now is solution that's inside the UDometer above the liquid level of the rest of the beaker. And so the rest of the liquid in the beaker, I'm going to draw with the dark blue. So I'm just trying to describe in a way to make this appear more three-dimensional somehow. Then we're going to have stuff up above it, which, there we go, if that color is showing up enough at all. Yeah, it kind of shows up. Well, that's going to be our hydrogen gas that's formed. All right? So, imagine that you had the magnesium tied to the stopper. You turn it upside down, you put it inside of this beaker. The hydrochloric acid dribbles down because it's more dense than the water is. And then eventually it hits the bit of magnesium metal here that was at the bottom. And then, just to help identify, this is the stopper that has the hole in it, remember, so liquid can get out of it. And so that's why the hydrogen bubbles up and gets collected. So if I can pull back to the previous page just for a moment, see, the three things we need, We need pressure, volume, and temperature that we're going to measure. So here's the volume right here in the udiometer. Because whatever space that's left over, and again, let me write here, udiometer, go away. Or out here, I'll just, where I have H2, we're going to measure that volume. So there we go. V for vendetta, or in this case, V for volume. And I'm being a bad instructor, I didn't label my diagram, so this is before the reaction. Which, if you've never seen it before, RxN is the universal, I'm too lazy to write the word, for reaction. And this is going to be after the reaction's over. When it's turned upside down, you've got that hydrogen that you've collected. All right. What about temperature? Well, we don't have a fancy thermometer probe that we're able to stick up inside of that udiometer. So what we do is we just measure it with a regular thermometer. And so this is where we measure the temperature, where I've indicated with the spot there. Oop. So there's our T for temperature. Now, what about pressure? Well, we could get a really fancy pressure meter of some type, but we're just going to assume that the pressure inside the lab is exactly the same as the pressure outside the lab. And you might recall me showing you in lecture the other day that De Anza has a weather station on top of it. So I literally just look up in lab what the weather station says, and that's what we use for the pressure. So the pressure is obtained from the De Anza weather station. Now you might think, oh, yeah, that's a lot of talking you did, but that doesn't sound so bad. You just do this thing, you watch some bubbles, bubble, 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 and you got temperature and volume and pressure, and you're done, right? No, of course not, because it's chemistry. It wouldn't be any fun if it was simple. That's going to be on some Twitter's blog tonight. Yeah, my instructor said it wouldn't be fun if it was simple. Okay. We have to make certain corrections to the pressure, which lower down here, let me write it the way that we talked about it initially. PT, which is this pressure that we're going to measure, the total pressure, turns out not to be the same as the pressure inside the uniometer. Because if it were, the level of the liquid on the inside and out would be the same. That's one thing. But there's also not just hydrogen gas in the tube. Those of you who actually read the lab manual, wow, then you might be prepared to answer this question. What other substance is there besides hydrogen? Come on, Internet, put your Fortnite down. You can answer this. What other substance is automatically present in this tube? That is exactly right. It is water. Why? Well, we had this discussion the other day. Remember, I think I talked about this thought problem. What would happen if you had a small quantity of water that was just left out in the open? And the answer is part of it would evaporate. So you don't just have hydrogen gas in there, you have water, as I'll explain further in just a moment. But there's another correction that I'll call P height. I'll explain that after I explain this thing about water. Now, that's the equation that we're going to work from, but in the lab, this is the equation you're going to use. Because earlier, I said we needed to solve for pressure, volume, and temperature. Well, we had to make an adjustment for the pressure. So this is the... No, that is the wrong color. This is the new pressure that we need to calculate. The pressure of just hydrogen itself. And that's going to be equal to the pressure total minus the pressure of hydrogen. Not hydrogen, what am I saying? Water. Minus P height. But now if I can use this bottom equation, let me break out and talk about this P water and P height. So the P water is due to vapor pressure. And if you recall, the discussion we had was this, that no matter what the temperature is we choose to talk about, at any temperature, molecules are going to have a variety of energies. And suppose there is some energy necessary to convert water into the vapor phase. Well, that's going to be the heat of vaporization. That's the term for how much energy it takes to go into the vapor phase. And the point of writing that on the diagram is that means that all these molecules here to the right have enough energy to evaporate. Now, let me go back and put my axes on like I'm supposed to. Here, this is the number of molecules for the y-axis, and the axis is the energy per molecule, or mole. Different books take different approaches. Means the same thing. It's a population graph. So the blue represents the fact that at room temperature, some molecules of water have the energy to evaporate. And that you can't stop. So that's why you automatically have to worry about water in your calculations. Now, what's this height thing about? Okay. Watch your instructor be high tech. Isn't that amazing? So let me clean that up a little bit to talk about. This is the same diagram up above, what we're going to have at the end of the reaction. Which technically there won't be any magnesium at the end of the reaction. So let me pretty that up a little bit. There we go. So earlier I commented out loud that the light blue versus the dark blue here represents a liquid that's inside the eudiometer tube above the level of the rest of the container. So there is a difference in height here between the top and the bottom. Now, why does that matter? Well, you might remember I was talking about heights of liquid when I was defining what pressure is. And so you might remember that the weight of the liquid in this column ends up being proportional to the height of the column itself. And that height ends up being a unit of pressure. So to say it in simpler language, this is all about the weight of water. That if you have water hanging out there above the level of the rest of the container, it's pushing down on the rest of the container, And it's part of what's fighting against this outside atmospheric pressure. So that's where this P height correction comes from. The weight of water above the level of the beaker. Contributes to the total pressure. Now we're going to cover all of this again pretty much on Monday when we talk about the lab again, because I'm going to give you a set of data pretending that we really did the experiment. So I'm going to go over again how to do the calculations, and so I'm going to talk in more detail about how to do this P height. Question is, isn't there also HC on the beaker? So yes, in theory you could have the vapor pressure of the HCl, which I'd have to look up to see if it really makes a difference or not. But technically, that's true. Thinking on my feet, much greater mole fraction of water present, which means in terms of total number of molecules, there's more water than HCl, so water probably has a much more drastic effect. That's me just thinking out loud. So, any other questions? HCl in the beaker still is in excess. That's right. So the waste still has hydrochloric acid in it. That's why magnesium ends up the limiting reagent.